All right, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to today's seminar on Taiwan's role in countering CCP political warfare. My name is Russell Hsiao. I'm the Executive Director of the Global Taiwan Institute. GTI is a 501c3 think tank dedicated to policy research and analysis. Launched only in 2016, our mission is to enhance the U.S.-Taiwan relationship by contributing to a more informed public discussion about Taiwan here in the United States and around the world. Towards that end, we undertake several major programs that include a biweekly publication featuring timely analysis about Taiwan, public seminars about Taiwan, an annual symposium on U.S.-Taiwan relations, fellowship opportunities, as well as cultural programs. Before we begin today's program, I would also like to thank the continued support of our co-founders, board members, advisors, staff, as well as our interns. I especially want to thank Richard Haddock and the Seeger, and our co-sponsor for today's event, the Seeger Center for Asian Studies, which is a university research institute and the academic home of the Asian Studies program of the Elliott School of International Affairs at the George Washington University. Its mission is to increase the quality and broaden the scope of scholarly research and publication on Asia, promote U.S.-Asian scholarly interaction, and educate a new generation of students, scholars, analysts, and policymakers. The center, founded in 1991 out of the Sino-Soviet Institute, was named for Gaston Seeger, Jr., a Japan specialist with a long career at the George Washington University, the National Security Council, and the U.S. Department of State, formerly serving as U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs from 1986 to 1989. So let's begin. The Trump administration's national security strategy, released in December 2017, issued a clear warning, and I quote, "State and non-state actors project influence and advance their objectives by exploiting information, democratic media freedoms, and international institutions. Repressive leaders often collaborate to subvert free societies and corrupt multilateral organizations," end quote. While Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. elections has commanded a lion's share of the public attention, the Chinese Communist Party is engaged in a comprehensive, coercive campaign that utilizes political warfare to influence and undermine democracies through various means. To be sure, there are imminent challenges from Russia's overt and covert interferences in the American political process. Yet the demographic, economic, and military challenges associated with China's rise and its rise in sharp power arguably presents a far more complex and strategic long-term challenge to the United States and Asian democracies. A hard look at how revisionist authoritarian powers exert its influence on the United States is necessary and long overdue. It's necessary not only because it's something people need to be concerned about, but also because it is essential that the U.S. government and American society address the issue with the appropriate, precise, and nuanced legal as well as policy responses. This is also a challenge that many democracies are facing. The rise of China's authoritarian influence is being felt throughout the world, most notably in Australia, Canada, Czech Republic, New Zealand, United States, and of course, Taiwan. It's worth pointing out that while Western countries are only coming to grips with this challenge, this seemingly mystic challenge, the government in Taiwan has the longest experience contending with CCP influence operations. In particular, Taiwan represents an important case study of CCP United Front activities, something that Chinese President Xi Jinping has called CCP's magic weapon and broader influence operation. Given the history of the Chinese Civil War and the strategic importance of the Taiwan issue for CCP leaders, Taiwan remains the United Front's number one priority. As a result of this long history, Taiwan also has the most intimate understanding of CCP United Front and political warfare operations. This is not only an issue of the past, but also the present. Most recently, just in mid-June, Taiwan prosecutors indicted the spokesman for a small political party, the New Party, and two other members for allegedly seeking to recruit Taiwan military officers on behalf of China and violating the country's National Security Act. Taiwan's national security apparatuses have also identified and made public cases in which content farms in the PRC were spreading fake news in Taiwan, especially during the height of social tensions, political tensions, as those over the military pension reforms. Just last week, the website of Taiwan's ruling DPP administration was hacked by most likely Chinese hackers. With the local elections coming up in Taiwan this November, there are also heightened concerns of Chinese election meddling. The motivations for Beijing are certainly there. All this to say that this is a shared challenge that necessitates a shared response. To help us better understand the who, what, how, and why of CCP political warfare, we're delighted to have been able to assemble our all-star panelists today to help us draw some clear lines around these issues. The difficulty, of course, is that their clear lines are very hard to draw. To my immediate left, I have Toshi Yoshihara, who is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. Previously, he held the John A. Van Buren Chair of Asia-Pacific Studies at the U.S. Naval War College, where he taught strategy for over a decade. He is also the recipient of the Navy Meritorious Civilian Service Award in recognition of his scholarship on maritime and strategic affairs at the Naval War College. To his left, we have Bethany Ellen Ibrahim, who is a security reporter at the Daily Beast and previously a contributing reporter at Foreign Policy. She was previously an assistant editor at Foreign Policy's China Channel, Tea Leaf Nation. She has appeared on CNN, C-SPAN, BBC, Al Jazeera, and a number of other international media outlets. She was a 2017 Arthur F. Burns Fellow in Berlin, a 2016 Jefferson Fellow at the East-West Center, and a 2015 Fellow with the International Reporting Project, among other postings. Last but not least, we have Shanti Kalatil. Did I get that right, hopefully? It's director of the International Forum for Democratic Studies at the National Endowment for Democracy. Previously in her career, she served as Senior Democracy Fellow at USAID, an associate with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, an associate with the Carnegie to the Study of Diplomacy at Georgetown University, and as a consultant at World Bank. And she was also a Hong Kong-based reporter for the Wall Street Journal Asia. So in keeping with the format of our public seminars, I prepared a set of questions that we'll present to each of the panelists. I invite the panelists to engage one another in the questions that they're presented with, and we will try to leave around 15 minutes at the end for audience Q&A. Well, to kick us off and set the context, because Toshi, you've written the most recent report and a very important, I think, contribution to the literature on this issue on countering comprehensive coercion, competitive strategy against authoritarian political warfare. I want to start off with you. Okay, so what are CCP's approaches to political warfare, and how do they serve the party's goals? I think I recall in your report that you draw a distinction between offensive and defensive political operations. What are the distinctions, and why do they matter when we talk about when we try to understand political warfare?
Sure. So what I'm actually going to do is make a couple of points.
Okay.
On the United Front Work Department, which is really one of many organs that wages political warfare, and then to use that as a window into Chinese political warfare writ large. So, as I said, the United Front Work Department is one of many institutions, including the Propaganda Department, the International Liaison Department, a variety of associations and federations associated with overseas Chinese. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs also is a key actor that provides cover for a lot of these political operatives. The Ministry of State Security, the Ministry of Public Security, and, of course, the PLA. Which, of course, has subsumed many of their three warfare's activities under this new body called the Strategic Support Force. So I just want to make clear that the United Front Work Department that I'll be talking about today is really one of many institutions. It's really an architecture. It's a constellation of actors that pushes China's aims. Mm-hmm. It's important to note that Xi elevated the United Front Work Department back in 2015. Mm-hmm. And I think this is important that he put his own personal capital in raising the strategic profile of the department, and he held a work conference. It was the first time in nearly a decade, and created a leading group. He's created all sorts of leading groups. Well, this is one of them. This is one of the leading groups of which he is chair, overlooking the interagency process in running the United Front. He issued regulations that was considered to be the party's first rule, that would govern United Front activities. And then the institution got a further boost back in March of 2018 after the National People's Congress basically allowed the United Front Work Department to absorb other state functions related to United Front. And so I think the first thing that I would say is that the United Front is clearly a institution. It's a bureaucratic organization, but it's also a concept, an idea that emerged in the very early parts of the Chinese Communist Party's history, and it's also a series of tactics that form together to essentially serve a larger strategy and larger Chinese aims. So let me get back to your question mm-hmm. about what are the party's goals, right? Mm-hmm. What's the goal of the United Front? And I think the United Front and all other organizations that pursue political warfare have very simple goals, I think. It's firstly, primarily, to keep the party in power and to promote the party's most important goals. And for the United Front Work Department, it includes things like promoting the China Dream, which is the so-called great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. In the United Front's own formulation, it's really about winning over as many people as possible that support the party and to reduce as many people as possible that oppose the party. And its mission is to befriend, entice, monitor, infiltrate, co-opt, coerce various peoples and groups that fall outside of the umbrella of the party. And so the Work Department in particular has a set of targets that it goes after in order to support those goals. Those include people that don't belong to the party, the intelligentsia, ethnic minorities, religious groups, the private sector, residents of Greater China, that would include Hong Kong, Macau, and Taiwan, and overseas Chinese of foreign nationalities, or Chinese nationals living overseas. And so organizationally, there are in fact 9 bureaus within the Work Department that focuses their work on each specific constituent to win them over and so forth. And so if you look at that target list, there's clearly an external component to the United Front Work Department. And so the writings talk about a strategy of 2 perimeters, meaning that there's 1 perimeter that's focused on the mainland, and then there's another broader perimeter, which is the rest of the world. And it's also important to know that in terms of the Work Department's external work, that their conception, its conception of its own writ is actually quite broad. So in theory, all ethnic Chinese are potential targets. And one of the things that really jumped out at me in one of their writings is that a key mission is to protect the legitimate rights and interests of overseas Chinese. And that's not surprising that analysts of United Front say that China is really engaging in activities that verges on extraterritoriality, right? Because it really is a broad conception of who might be legitimate targets. And for me, for someone who really spent most of his time studying the Chinese Navy, this idea of legitimate rights and interests resonates, or at least rings alarm bells with me, because when the Chinese make these excessive maritime claims in maritime Asia, they also say that China is trying to defend their legitimate maritime rights and interests, mm-hmm. which are broad, ambiguous, frequently excessive, ambiguous enough that China can really say anything to include in this idea of rights and interests. And so that would be my answer to that mm-hmm. question.
Well, but you also draw a distinction between offensive and defensive. So can you just kind of go over really what the distinction is and why that sort of matters in our assessment of political warfare operations?
Yeah, so I think there is this important point, which is that the United Front is clearly going global, that second perimeter that I talked about. And it's important to note that this isn't new. The United Front sought to cultivate relations with overseas Chinese businesses to reconnect the Chinese economy to the rest of the global economy as early as the late 1970s. As early as September of 1977, Deng Xiaoping, in meeting visiting overseas Chinese, basically said that we need to revive and reinstitutionalize overseas Chinese work. And that was a clear signal that he was going to turn his back on the radicalism of the Cultural Revolution. But the idea of this offense-defense thing is that the idea is that the best form of defense is a good offense, which is this idea that China needs to take the ideological struggle overseas, take the fight out there to win the hearts and minds of various audiences, to defend China's policies, China's worldviews, China's ideas, China's image by engaging in a variety of audiences, including local civic organizations, to promote China's view on things on Taiwan, the One Country, Two Systems, and increasingly these days, they're out there promoting the Belt and Road Initiative. So in my view, it is a form of, it's a non-material form of power projection. And in that sense, there's an even more fundamental goal, in my view, which is, to borrow from Professor Aaron Friedberg from Princeton, is that the goal is to make the world safe for authoritarianism. United Front seeks to influence debates and policies in ways that make the external security environment more amenable to the CCP's policies, but also, importantly, more amenable to the very nature of the regime. So you want to get countries that are not like-minded or don't share your values, like Western democracies, to see the CCP as a partner, as a business partner, to see it in a relationship that's largely transactional, very business-like, and to get those to stop viewing China through the lens of ideology, to convince others that China has a superior mode of governance and a model for development, and to align views with those that agree with or conform to China's worldview. And I think when we think about the broader illiberal trends that we see in international system, to borrow a Soviet phrase, it's that what we're seeing is the correlation of forces shifting in China's favor. And so, again, these are presumably defensive goals, right? China is trying to maintain the survival of the party, to defend China's interests. But for those on the receiving end of political warfare, it's clearly quite offensive.
Well, thank you, Toshi. And you touched on this briefly in your opening statement, but perhaps you can maybe elaborate a little bit more on this, is that how is the CPP organized to wage political warfare?
Well, I think it's important to note that the phrase that you use, magic weapon, that actually has a really long, long history. It actually emerged, first of all, let me just talk about the idea, right, which is that this idea of the United Front emerged in the early 1920s. In fact, it emerged within the year of the party's founding, which was to essentially form an alliance of convenience with the party's arch-rival, the Nationalists, and then to eat away at the enemy from the inside out. I kind of think of this as almost like a biological virus, like the Ebola virus, that infects the host and eats the host from the inside out. This is importantly a Leninist idea, and the Chinese used this idea very explicitly through the first United Front that ended in disaster in 1927, the second United Front in the war against Japan, and then through a post-revolution China. So I want to get back to this point about magic weapon, which is that it was first used actually by Mao Zedong in October of 1939, and he said basically that there are three ways to think about the standing up of the Chinese Communist Party, and there are three magic weapons. One is the United Front, the second is armed struggle, and the third is party building. So in many ways, these three magic weapons parallels the way the party today seeks to maintain power, which is, again, through propaganda, through the PLA, and through personnel selection. And so I think we have to think about United Front as a magic weapon in that context, that it is organized really to essentially seek to maintain the power of the party. And I think the other point to make is that the United Front as a concept is really deeply embedded in the party's institutional memory and history.
You know, we're often very focused in our discussion now about, you know, how CCP political warfare is influencing our society internally, and literally less about activities that it has internationally, right? And you wrote something that I found very interesting in your report, and I quote here, part of Xi's vision appears to be fostering a growing group of like-minded revisionist countries that, over time, may constitute an international partnership, alliance, or even a China-centered empire. That's very interesting. Can we articulate that thought some more so that we can better understand what the international dimensions of this of CCP political warfare?
Yeah, so I think I'm just going to, I mean, in some ways repeat what I've just stated earlier, which is that there's clearly an external dimension to United Front work, and that one of the key goals is to use United Front tactics to essentially realign the views of those external to China to make them view China's policies more favorably. And mm-hmm. so, again, if you have countries that share your values, and the more that they share your values in number, the better it is. So I think, again, you can think about that alignment in terms of, you know, correlation of forces. So as long as there are more, if there are more illiberal regimes that shares China's viewpoints, then that's all to the good, because it actually makes it more favorable in terms of China's security environment.
Thank you. Bethany, I'd like to move over to you. You've been tracking contemporary CCP interference operations here in the United States more than any other American reporter that I'm aware of. Can you break out CCP influence operations activities here in the United States? Who are they, and what are they doing?
So Toshi has given a really great introduction to how the United Front works. Is this on?
Can you hear me? Is it on? Move it up a little bit. Oh, yeah, it's on. Mm-hmm.
Better? Okay. So what he said about wanting to co-opt, coerce, infiltrate organizations, and that very largely and often targets ethnic Chinese, that is something that is most definitely happening in the United States and has been happening for a long time. So I'm just going to go back in history a little bit to the early 90s. So after Tiananmen Square, the Chinese Communist Party realized that it had a problem. It had a global image problem. Many Chinese at that time left China to go abroad. And what the CCP did not want was a repeat of what had happened at the beginning of the 20th century, where there were these democracy movements that were flourishing outside of China. Obviously Sun Yat-sen did a lot of his. He was in Hawaii. He was in Japan. And so what the Communist Party did not want was a repeat of that, where there are very strong pro-democracy intellectual movements flourishing abroad that then can come back into China and change the regime. And so in the 90s, the United Front really made a big push, a big global push to get out of mainland China and to engage with, to try to guide overseas Chinese communities around the world. This most certainly happened inside the United States. And so you see in the 90s a gradual, I really dislike the word infiltrate, a gradual kind of influence over, the overseas Chinese communities here. So, for example, in the 90s, quite a number of Chinese people affiliated with state media outlets and with the United Front were basically sent to the United States to set up pro-Beijing Chinese language media outlets that were independent but not really. So, for example, there is, one media outlet, and let me just say, so I can't be sued, Taobao, the overseas Chinese press, is based in the U.S. and has no official financial ties to the Chinese Communist Party. Let me just say that. They were founded in 1992 by someone who previously worked for a Chinese state media outlet, came here, have been very, very pro-Beijing ever since. And so that is, that's an example of a type of supposedly independent outlet that, promotes Beijing's official views within the United States. There are a large number of those outlets. At the same time, you've seen a lot of pressure being placed on actually independent media outlets. So there's a scholar in California, John Pomfret, who's been doing a lot of research on this. And there are very, very few truly independent Chinese language media outlets left in the United States. The ones that are independent are affiliated with the Falun Gong mostly. And so how that kind of pressure works, if we're talking about media outlets, is either Chinese businesses will be pressured in a way, and they will withdraw funding, advertising from local media outlets that have run articles that go against the party line. That's one way that it happens. Another way that it happens is, media outlets in China, China Radio International or other state-run outlets will come to media outlets here and say, look, we'll give you free content. Isn't that great? We'll give you, we'll subsidize what you're doing. We'll give you free training. We'll give you free equipment. all you have to do is just, you know, don't say anything that, you know, really goes against what we want. And that, over time, the combination there of the carrot and the stick is very difficult to push back against, and is very effective. So that's, you know, the media outlets example is one example of how that kind of pressure has been very real in the United States. But let me talk directly about the United Front. So what there's, it operates in the United States very frequently through Chinese organizations, community organizations, businesses, professional associations. Some of these, were founded, Chinese people, when they come to the U.S., are like any other people. They form associations, they form community groups. This is normal and, you know, a positive part of a real and active civil society. Through a similar kind of carrot and stick approach, since the 90s, many of these organizations have also been co-opted in a similar way as media outlets. You know, so we'll give you funding, we'll give you business opportunities back in China, we'll come in and vote out your leadership and vote in people who are pro-Beijing, so that gradually over time, many professional associations, community organizations, Tongxianghui, which are the homeland organization, hometown organizations, you know, like the Fujian hometown organization or something like that, or Zhejiang, whatever, so that these organizations that represent the Chinese community themselves are also going to be in alignment with Beijing. What the United Front also does is it has actually, or United Front linked officials, they actually will come in and form, actual organizations of their own. And so a really great example of that are the Peaceful Reunification Societies. So there's something called the China Council for the Peaceful Reunification. It gets translated in different ways, but it's directly linked to the United Front Work Department. There's a main office in Beijing. They have branches in more than 70 countries around the world, and they have branches in more than 30 cities across the United States, including right here in Washington, D.C. And if you want to do what I have done, which is trace out United Front networks inside of the United States, a great place to start is to go to each one of these Peaceful Reunification Societies and look at their leadership. So who is the president, who's the vice chairman, look at that, and then, you know, look at their statements that they have made to supposedly independent Chinese language media outlets, and you'll see, you know, that they are meeting with United Front officials in China, they're meeting with United Front officials here in the United States, and so what you get from this whole complete picture of, you know, no longer having independent Chinese language media outlets, of many Chinese community associations, professional associations, student groups, including, you know, the right here on the campus of George Washington University. What you get is a society within a society. So, you know, we have, you know, the United States, we supposedly have freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. But amongst the overseas Chinese community, it has become very difficult in the past 25 years to organize in as free a way as maybe other Americans can, because of the slow pressure from the United Front, from United Front officials. You know, if you want to have, you know, views that support like an independent Taiwan, or, you know, if you don't like the Communist Party, you can have those views. But if you want to organize around that, if you want to publish Chinese language editorials about that, if you want to have, you know, if you want to set up a national organization, to express your views, to have demonstrations, it becomes very difficult. You face a lot of pressure that comes from a lot of different areas of society, from businesses, from other organizations. And to that extent, this is a civil rights issue inside the United States that I think that, you know, our lawmakers, our media outlets have done a poor job of protecting, you know, Chinese Americans and Chinese communities from the pressure and, you know, quite frankly, the authoritarian policies that the Chinese Communist Party is trying to extend over here. It's also very difficult because when the United Front targets Chinese Americans, that in and of itself can foment racial divisions, you know, in this country and suspicions. And in this particular moment in our politics, you know, xenophobia and nativism is a real problem. And so even having a discussion like this about how, you know, the CCP purposefully targets Chinese citizens abroad or even ethnic Chinese abroad who are, you know, citizens of different countries, I think can create an aura of suspicion. And that is perhaps one goal of the Chinese Communist Party, because what does the party want? It wants to represent all Chinese. It wants to say, we are the only ones who can protect Chinese inside of China. We are the only ones who can protect Chinese outside of China. And if, you know, in the U.S., people, we've seen this some with Chinese scientists who have been at times, you know, wrongly targeted for espionage accusations. If there's a feeling here that, you know, Chinese are the target of racism, doesn't that prove the party's point that, you know, the party is the only one who can protect them?
Well, you know, Bethany, I mean, let me just hold you there. I mean, I think, but, you know, isn't it true that every government tries to influence, you know, another government? And so difficulty seems to me about sorting between legitimate and malign types of activities that we talk about when, you know, influences. So can you sort of help us sort this out a little bit? How do you distinguish between what is, you know, benign or legitimate activities versus what is malign activities?
Right. I mean, there's a lot of different countries in the world and countries do different things. And if you look at the United States, we have a whole range of things that we have done, including, you know, overthrowing a democratically elected prime minister in Iran. That was not great. That would be a kind of malign influence. We also, you know, have really great organizations like the National Endowment for Democracy that, you know, give funds to people abroad to try to bring them over to our ideology, which is democracy. So what's the difference between that and, you know, what we see as, you know, what the United Front is doing here? Well, part of what happens here, you know, inside the U.S. and elsewhere is that there is a suppression and a coercion that is often covert. So in Australia, some terminology that has now been adopted by the government there is, you know, to talk about CCP influence is that it is coercive, corrupt, and covert. A lot of times if you're trying to suss out how it works, like, so one thing that United Front officials do in the U.S. is they will identify donors. So they'll go through donor lists for, you know, elected officials, and they'll say, look at these people who are donating a lot. Let's target them so that the next time they give a donation, you know, they can, you know, say, well, you know, we think you should support Beijing's claims in the South China Sea or whatever. And that is the kind of thing that the U.S. tends to do and not be proud of. You know, like, that's maybe what some of our agencies do abroad that's classified. So it's not like we don't do it. But there's an element of coercion, of suppressing speech, of preventing people from expressing themselves freely. And that is certainly malign. Mm-hmm. Let me give a quick example of how it can differ legally, because we're talking about things that maybe are about ideology and morality, but not so much about laws. Mm. So in the United States, if a person informs on someone's dissident community, so let's say someone is collecting information about Uyghurs here in the U.S. for China, just personal information, and they pass that along. That is not illegal. That is completely legal. It's not good. I don't think it's moral, but it's not illegal. So there's no way to prosecute that person who's doing that. That's not true in Sweden. You know, last month or 2 months ago, a person was arrested in Sweden for doing that exact thing on the Tibetan community. So in Sweden, that behavior is most certainly illegal. But it's not in the U.S., so our laws are different. So it depends a little bit on how you define it.
Well, Bethany, that's a great segue to my next question. I'm sticking with you here right now, is that the U.S. Congress is not sitting on its hand, right? I mean, can you go over what you see Congress is doing to address these issues that, you know, you've highlighted?
Well, there's been a lot of positive movement forward in the past 6 months, and a lot of that is due to Marco Rubio. People have different opinions about his politics in general, and I certainly don't agree with everything that he says or does. But on the issue of CCP influence and the United Front, he's really quite good. And he's not the only one, but there's a growing interest in both the House and the Senate around this issue, and that's good. So there's a couple of things that I will point out that are definitely steps in the right direction. And these both involve transparency, and a lot of United Front activity dies in the sunlight. And that's an important point to make because to the extent that we're talking about narratives and about China winning the war for its image and winning the war over its narrative, in a liberal democracy, a lot of that cannot be legislated because that's the whole point. So there a resolution that was introduced. Saying that, and it had bipartisan support, so there was a whole group of Democrats and Republicans who supported it, saying that the U.S. government should come up with an interagency non-classified report on United Front activity in the United States. Now that's important because the U.S. government has been tracking United Front for a long time, and it has not released any information about what it knows, and that's really frustrating. Unlike Australia, where intelligence officials have been, the government has been more forthcoming. So that would bring a lot of this out into the sunlight, where we can have a debate, about, for example, when Chinese groups are paid by the embassy to come and, show their support for Xi Jinping when he visits D.C. And in doing so, they actively try to prevent, Falun Gong practitioners and other dissidents from expressing their views. If they want to just occupy the space. I mean, that's something that actually happens. They say, occupy the space so that these people, can't express their opinions to Xi Jinping. And that kind of thing changes our debate because we look at that and we think, oh, wow, look at all these people who really just love the Chinese Communist Party. But if there's transparency about that, it kind of kills it. It kills the covert nature of that way to change the debate. So to have, a report about it, a public report would be great. There was also a letter that was, again, it was signed by a bipartisan group of 12 senators. It was written to Pompeo and Mattis and Christopher Wray, head of the FBI, saying, would you please let us know, we think you should have a strategy to counter this, to counter Chinese pushback against Western and liberal democracy, and let us know if you have a strategy. We deserve to know what that is, and if you don't, can you please formulate one? So these are very good and positive steps forward, and I'm glad to say that so far, the more extreme versions of what this could be, because what we do not want is a sense of, we don't want the U.S. government to end up with a relationship with the Chinese community similar to the relationship it has with the American Muslim community. We don't want them to feel like they're being targeted in that way. And so far, it is going well.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you made a very interesting observation when you said occupy the space and how, the Chinese, CCP United Front is trying to, basically occupy the space to prevent the free speech by other groups that it disagrees with. And I think this goes to my question for you, Shanti, because one of a critical space in this era now is the information space, right, in cyberspace. And the information and communication technology revolution, and in particular the internet, have expanded our ability to interact with one another and also our governments in multiple ways. The inverse is true. It allows our governments to interact more with us. Generally in the West, I think the debate about cyberspace, information space is framed in terms of civil liberties and the balance between civil liberties and security. But I feel like the CCP has a very different view about the global information space and the system. And you've written a great report about this for NED, and I perhaps you could tell us a little bit more how you see the CCP view the global information system.
Sure. To begin with, take you back a few years when people were still trying to understand how the Chinese government was attempting to shape political expression just within its own borders. This was when the Great Firewall was being developed. And I think there was a perception at that time, particularly before the internet really spread throughout China, that the dominant approach, at least internally, was to just clamp down and to squash that space and to have it be a very sanitized place that contained no attractions for people, really, so that people within China that wanted any kind of information would feel like they had to jump out and go access some sources outside. I think if you look at that space now, even with the, I would say, the tightening of that space in recent years, and particularly under Xi Jinping, it's really quite a vibrant space. I mean, you can go to China and wave your cell phone at something and pay for any number of things and take care of your life in ways that will seem to us, living in the U.S., like some kind of technological miracle, because it links together seamlessly so many different aspects of your life. And in some ways, that can be quite appealing. Moreover, you will find lots of information that you might find interesting. You'll find entertainment news. You can follow the celebrities and the singers and all the pop stars that you want. You can engage in certain types of debate and discussion and have a very rich kind of internet experience. The metaphor that I think best captures this, as opposed to the Great Firewall, is something more of a walled garden. If you think of the CCP as the gardener trying to encourage certain blooms to take root and have some kind of flowering variety of different colors, and yet to ruthlessly weed out anything that might be displeasing, that to me is a metaphor that makes a little bit more sense for the development of the information space within China. Mm-hmm. Critically, that approach is now being brought to bear outside of China's borders. And this is something that I think marks a real change, particularly in just the last few years. I think if you had made that case prior to the last few years, people would say, you know, I really don't buy that. But what's changed is that, in particular, the Chinese internet firms that were nourished and nurtured behind the walls of that garden, which were allowed to grow big and which benefited from certainly the direction of the state, they're now big enough to take that approach globally. And increasingly, some of these firms are engaging with the outside world. As you know, there's a lot of ties between the Chinese tech sector and the outside world. And in addition to that, I think the approach taken by the Chinese government has remained consistent. And that approach, I would say, generally breaks down into three main elements. First, it's the technology. So in the original conception of the Great Firewall, the censorship system for the Chinese internet, there was a lot of reliance on the infrastructure, on censoring materials, not simply at one level, but making that redundant throughout many layers of the system so that you could shut off whole pipes, or you could be very granular in going into sort of, you know, at the time people would talk about deep packet sniffing, mm-hmm. pulling out specific pieces of information to get ever more granular in the way that censorship is enabled. So technology. The second aspect is that it's not about just technology. It actually really relies on a complex interplay between technology and the promotion of self-censorship, which is inherent in the Chinese system. So you really can't have this type of information approach without some agreed understanding that you're going to censor yourself and you are going to manage yourself in this space, or essentially bad things will happen. The third is that all of this is predicated on that relationship between both private citizens in the state as well as firms, corporations in the state, which is, I think people have mentioned this carrot and stick approach, but essentially that if you play by our rules, then you will benefit. And if you contravene those rules, you will suffer some kind of sanction. Now, the Chinese technology firms have certainly done very well within that broad framework of knowing where those lines are, being able to innovate in some cases quite tremendously in some places, and yet knowing how to do so in a way that will not get them crosswise with the interests of the party. Mm-hmm. So again, this multi-layered approach is being brought to bear outside of China now. So that, again, it's about the technology. It's not just about the technology. It's also predicated on these mutually shared understandings, which I think Bethany and Toshi have talked about a little bit, sort of the idea that, you know, you self-censor yourself because you understand that there are certain lines that you don't cross. And again, you don't do that unless there is this kind of relationship which can provide both benefits in some cases but also can be extremely coercive in other cases. Mm-hmm. And that, I think explains that broad approach to the global information space.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as both Toshi and Bethany alluded to, United Front work involves mobilization, indoctrination, indoctrination control of a lot of non-CCP masses. How is and can the CCP utilize the tools of the information age to wage political warfare or influence operations, in your perspective?
So, you know, the things that I typically look at, I would say, probably don't fall within the rubric of political warfare, perhaps, but certainly you can see that they would represent some form of CCP influence that would serve to restrict certain either liberties or freedoms. So, for instance, if you look at the CCP's involvement in the media space outside its borders, I think Bethany has already done a good job of outlining how that happens, particularly with respect to Chinese language media. But, you know, it's not only in the case of Chinese language media. So, for instance, if you look at what's happening on the African continent in certain countries, the Chinese government has poured tremendous resources into shaping the information space and the media space of those countries. And so that's done both through official state-owned organs like CGTN, used to be CCTV, now CGTN, where that can be quite a prominent feature of the television and the digital landscape, or through other ways, say through cable providers. So, you know, in Nigeria and other countries, Star Times, which is a big Beijing cable provider, is going in there and offering really sweet deals and offering perks like, say, World Cup coverage or other things to draw people to those packages. But there are certain aspects of that system that I think the populations of those countries are not fully cognizant of. And I think this is part of the issue, is that as these companies and as the CCP tries to expand this influence over the global information space, in some of the bigger liberal democracies, there are the resources to try to cover these things and to fully exploitate this issue. Bethany herself has reported on a lot of these things in the U.S., but that's, I would say, actually quite an unusual case. I think in many of these situations, particularly in vulnerable democracies in developing countries, there's simply not the resources to understand what's happening. And so a lot of these things end up getting rolled out, whether it's technological cooperation, whether it's the participation of either state companies or state-linked companies in providing critical infrastructure, in providing the infrastructure for smart cities. A lot of these things are happening in real time. They're just going completely under-scrutinized, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Well, in your report, Beyond the Great Firewall, How China Became a Global Information Power, for anyone who hasn't read it yet, I highly recommend it. It's on NAD's website. You warned about the dawning of an authoritarian information age. Tell us more about what you saw and what you see and why you wrote that.
So, in that report, I looked at a few different areas. One was sort of this media space, which I just touched on, and sort of those ideas related to the governance of the Internet, sort of the idea that the Internet would become balkanized according to China's own vision of enabling individual countries to set the rules for the Internet within their own borders, and thus essentially sabotage the idea of the global Internet as a free and open Internet that could be a resource for everybody. So that's one area. The other was sort of looking at the technology, the media space, and the third was looking at cultural production. And that's, to me, if you're looking at a specific example where it was really striking for me to delve into, because I'm a bit of a movie buff, I would go to movies and kind of wonder why I was only seeing positive depictions of China or the Chinese science program. It piqued my interest enough to sort of have a section of this report devoted to it. And the truth is that because of these extensive tie-ups between Hollywood companies and Chinese film production companies, and because the Chinese market is so important now to Hollywood and indeed all film industries all over the world because it's such a vast potential market, there's so much incentive for films, cultural products to be shaped at the source in ways that don't offend China, or the Chinese government, I should say. Mm-hmm. And that is, while you may not say that's an authoritarian environment, it's certainly not one in which you see the full diversity of views, and it's one which is being proactively shaped to suit the preferences of an authoritarian government. And in this, you know, maybe I would frame it a little bit differently as I've been thinking about it, because, you know, when I originally wrote that report, I originally envisioned this as a problem that would be, you know, similar to the way that Toshi put it. You have this group of like-minded countries, all either authoritarian, leaning authoritarian, or liberal, that would use China as a model, and China would seek to maybe export some of those techniques. But increasingly, even in the time that since when I put together that report in late 2016 till now, I think where you see the most interesting examples and perhaps the most troubling examples of these things happening is within democracies that have very different value systems. And I think to me the danger is not so much that these democracies will suddenly become authoritarian or liberal and hew to Chinese values, but that they will simply accept the slow erosion of their own democratic values because they prioritize their relationship with China. And to me, I think China would be happy with that. I don't know that the Chinese government would necessarily want or need the whole world to become authoritarian, but, and Toshi, I know you quoted Aaron Friedberg here, to make the world safe for authoritarianism, essentially democracies have to give up that essential piece of their own character, which, unfortunately, I think that we have seen happening in a number of countries around the world. So maybe that's parsing it out a little bit more, but either way, it redounds to the benefit of the CCP.
That's great. Thank you. And I've prepared a few communal questions I'm going to just ask all of the panelists to address here. And you know, start however you like. You know, whoever wants to start with it. So we've talked a lot about what the issue is and what the problem is. And so how can the United States work better with her democratic allies and partners respond to this challenge of CCP influence operations, political warfare? Bethany, I see you nodding, so maybe we can start.
Yeah, okay. Well, this is not a great political moment for the United States to be working closely with its democratic allies and partners, since our president seems determined to blow those up. But to the extent that many people within the U.S. government still strongly believe in multilateral institutions, still strongly believe in alliances and the value of democracy, there is a lot that can be done, and a lot that is being done. You know, one thing that is happening, not in the public eye, is a lot of intelligence sharing. So, the Five Eyes, if you're familiar with that, is a grouping. It's New Zealand, Australia, Canada, the United States, and I believe the UK. They do a lot of intelligence sharing, and they specifically do a lot of intelligence sharing around the issue of covert Chinese influence within their own countries. So they are that is functioning. That's working well. You know, what else can democracies do? Well, we can, you know, get together to learn from each other. So Germany right now is kind of at the very beginning of looking at, they're looking to China, you know, for economic deals, for all kinds of, you know, as maybe an alternative pro-free trade partner, now that the U.S. is not so pro-free trade anymore. But they're also having to look at what's going on, what strings does that come with? You know, so what we can do, what Canada, Australia, New Zealand can do is reach out to Germany and try to say, look, this is what we've found in our own countries. This is what we've tried. It's worked. It hasn't worked. Right now, Australia just passed, I believe they passed a big law, really the first attempt by a liberal democracy to address these kinds of covert or subtle kinds of influence that we've been talking about today that take advantage of vulnerabilities in a democracy. So Australia has passed some laws about that. So, you know, what we should do as a community of democracies is to learn from that and to say, look, this worked, that didn't work. Those are some things that can be done.
Toshi?
Yeah. So I think the starting point, at least from the way I read the United Front, is really to understand the United Front's or the party's worldview. And I think that's the starting point to understand what it means to the West. And I think they have a deeply ideological worldview, and I think there are three kind of words I would use, fear, loathing, and paranoia, that I think colors the party's worldview. And part of it is that it does believe that it is in a kind of a permanent war with the West. It's not just what the West does, but it's what the West is, what the West represents. And there is this belief that the West is actively seeking to either slow down China's rise, particularly the United States, seeking not only to oppose China's rise, but also to undermine the the very survival of the regime. So they see Western culture, norms, ideas, and so forth as an existential threat. And they tend to attribute all of the political revolutions around the world to the West. So all the color revolutions, the Arab Spring, that's the West's kind of black hand behind all of this. When the party heard about the U.S. strategy during the Clinton administration of enlargement and engagement, what they heard, of course, was, what the party heard was regime change, right? It was an attempt to split and westernize China. And I think that belief persists. So I think in understanding that worldview, I think the key, the first implication for the West is that we're in it together, right? Because the United Front sees the West as a collective threat to the party's long-term aspirations and even its survival. So I think in a way, we have to be more comfortable with or become more closely reacquainted with the kind of the ideological component of America's grand strategy in Asia. So that's point one. I think the second point is that I think we should begin to think about this in terms of more classical strategy terms, meaning we should be able to apply strategy to this challenge. And one way to think about it is to think about this in terms of competitive strategies, which is this idea that in these competitions, ideally you want to pit your strengths against your opponent's weaknesses. And in some ways, that's what the Chinese have been doing to the West, right? To go after those seams, to go after the very open nature of our democratic systems as a potential vulnerability. But again, if we want to think of this in terms of a competition, how do we turn that on its head? Well, what are some of China's weaknesses? What are some of our strengths that we can devote our strengths to their weaknesses? These are mostly just questions and thoughts right now, but certainly it seems to me that the CCP's paranoid worldview and its tendency to attribute all bad things to the West suggests to me that there are some, in some ways, cognitive biases, perhaps, predispositions to believe in certain things that we could potentially exploit as a part of our long-term strategy. So I think we need to start thinking about this in terms of a long-term competition, and perhaps competitive strategies might provide some hints for how the West can apply a counter-strategy over the long term.
Go ahead.
I can just add on to that really quickly. I think that's a great point about valuing what we do have. So, like, you know, one thing that liberal democracies do well is we have our own flourishing civil societies. We need to mobilize those civil societies into this discussion. So here's an example. I mean, what the United Front does or what China does is it creates fake civil society. So, for example, 10 years ago, you may remember the very large global demonstrations, pro-Beijing, pro-China demonstrations around the Olympics, and a lot of Chinese people in capitals, cities all around the world mobilized to be angry about, Tibet or things like that. Much of that was not organic. It was mobilized through United Front networks, and that is not widely known, and it should be. Why should it be? So that we as a civil society understand that we need to be talking about this, that we need to be talking about our own values and mobilizing in our own ways. So I think that was a great point. Mm.
Shanti?
Yeah, I mean, actually, that builds. I'll just build on that. Mm-hmm. I think, so much of the discussion within democracy has been about policy responses, and certainly if you're in Congress or anywhere else, you want to do something about it. Well, if you are a policymaker in a democracy and you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. But to be honest, some of the things that we're talking about can't be addressed with a blunt hammer instrument of policy. It does require a more nuanced approach, an approach that reflects the diversity of views in society that would be reflected by a civil society approach. And to counter something as hard to grasp as United Front activities, you do need an active and engaged civil society that is speaking out loudly in defense of democratic values. And this, I think, helps get around the whataboutism problem, because certain individual democracies have warts, that's to put it mildly, at the moment. But democratic values themselves have an enduring appeal that are inherent. I mean, that is something that people all over the world will ascribe readily to. And that's something where I think civil society has a unique role to play, because it doesn't have to be wedded to particular governments. It can be transnational, even. The responses that are forged by democracies can be independent of their own government's responses, and they can seek to address those issues that may not be within policy's purview. So, for instance, you know, on the issue of academic freedom or what should happen on campuses, that's a role that academics and people in the scholarly community and civil society can discuss and really get into greater detail and a more nuanced discussion about than can really be had at the policy level. And maybe that's more appropriate as well.
So the former defense secretary, Rumsfeld, is popularly known to have said that there are known unknowns, there are things we know, we also know that there are unknown unknowns. That is to say, we know that there are some things we do not know, but there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know. So I'll make the question simple. What do we want to know more about CCP United Front?
All right, I guess I'll start. I think what we've been observing thus far is really Chinese political warfare in a largely peacetime environment. So I would be curious to know how these organs and how the agents of political warfare might act in times of crisis, for example, in an escalating crisis or even in a wartime scenario. To use military terms, how do these institutions operate in phase one and phase two, right? So phase zero is the peacetime. Phase one, phase two is leading up to conflict, and phase three is outright conflict. So what's their place and what's their role in those kinds of situations? And that leads me to my next question, which is, you know, what are the institutional and operational connections between these institutions and the PLA, and the PLA's doctrine or philosophy of the three warfares, which is actually separate from, I think, some of the things that we've been discussing in terms of United Front. What's interesting is that, as I read the PLA's own official histories, is that they do mention the coordinated roles of the United Front and the PLA's political work, which is designed to disintegrate the enemy's will, which is what the three warfares is about. During the Chinese Civil War. So how might that be applied in the 21st century context? And I'm thinking here, obviously, in the Taiwan context. In times of a cross-strait crisis, how do these various actors interact and help to promote each other's aims? The second thing that I want to know a bit more is really to kind of have a broad canvas, a kind of a net assessment of Chinese political warfare activities across all of Asia. Sort of a balance sheet of how these activities are taking place in Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Philippines, Thailand, New Zealand, and Australia. And a broad picture of perhaps patterns that we can capture or some sharp asymmetries or differences because of the unique local conditions in those countries and what that might tell us about both the strengths and weaknesses of Chinese political warfare, and also perhaps to give a sense of whether there is something much more coherent, right? That there is a larger coherent framework and a larger coherent regional strategy that's perhaps driving these political warfare activities.
A quick plug on, because you brought up the PLA, is a study that I participated in. It's published by the Project 2049 Institute, co-author. I was one of the co-authors, but the executive director of Mark Stokes. And I wrote this report in 2013, focused on the General Political Department and its role, particularly the International Liaison Department, and its role in engaging in political warfare. And so I highly recommend you to read that report. It's on Project 2049's website. It's published in 2013.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is my wish list of things I want to know. There's this concept of dark money, so money that goes into politics, into campaigns, and we don't really know the source of it. And there's several different ways that this can happen. It can happen through nonprofit organizations. It can happen through several different ways. I want to know how much of an effort the party, the Chinese Communist Party, is making to get that money into U.S. politics. We know more about that in Australia. Here's an interesting anecdote from Australia. I think it was Xi Jinping's book, The Governance of China, is that what it's called? Mm. Was sold at an auction for $60 bazillion Australian dollars. We don't know where that money actually came from, and the auction was to benefit some candidate. This is a way that money can get into Australian politics. So I really want to know, and it is not known. There are no reports. I don't think there are even any classified reports about how much party money is getting into local, state, and national U.S. politics. I'm sure it's a lot more than we think it is. Second, and this is something that keeps Western intelligence officials up at night, if there were a crisis in U.S.-China relations, how would these networks mobilize? So again, to go back to the 2008 Olympics, that was massive global covert political mobilization that happened in a dozen countries. Had a very strong effect on our narrative, the global narrative about China. We thought, oh my gosh, look at all these people who really support, China. I guess maybe there's, maybe the party has some good points. I mean, that really affected how we think about things. The United Front organizations haven't done that very much since then because it attracted a lot of attention from various intelligence agencies around the world. What will happen if they pull out all the stops on that? We decide to bomb one of the, South China Sea Islands, or, I don't know, something like that. How many demonstrations will we see? I mean, what will happen if they pull out all the stops? So that's something we don't know. And then third, something we also don't fully understand is the relationship between the United Front Work Department and other, Satoshi mentioned other agencies. So for example, the PLA Political Liaison Department, the Ministry of State Security, which would be, China's standard spy agency. There are relationships there. To some extent, the United Front Work Department identifies people or creates channels, that the MSS can then go in and use. But it's not well understood. And that's something that, that happens right here in Washington, D.C. But how it works is not fully understood.
Shanti?
And this is actually something I've been trying to find out more about. I would love to know more about the CCP's disinformation capabilities overseas. Surprisingly, there isn't really that much publicly available about this, and there are some examples from Taiwan, and Russell's written about this, and others have written about these instances, but there's very little systematic study that's been done about this. And if you assume that there are folks within China, within the PLA and other places who are actively watching what Russia has been able to successfully do, not just within the United States, but to essentially disrupt democratic processes in other places, and you pair that with what we also know, which is that they are actively developing the capacity to take that disinformation issue and that tool and leverage it up to an extent that we haven't really even seen. If you think about the capacities that are enabled through artificial intelligence to, for instance, innovate in what's called deepfakes, to produce things that seem so real, but you just have no way really of distinguishing what's real and what isn't. And to take that outside of the Chinese language space. I hear what's being done here and there in Taiwan and Hong Kong, and I just have no idea about the real capabilities and the real thinking there. But I would bet that there are a lot of really smart people within China that are studying this actively, and I would love to know, if it's a question of hide your capabilities and bide your time, what capabilities are being hidden, and for how long will that time be waiting?
Well, we can't possibly end a discussion here without addressing, of course, the big question, and which is what the seminar is framed around, and that is, really after all this discussion about the challenges, about the issues, really, what is Taiwan's role in countering CCP political warfare? Toshi, you want to start?
Sure. So I think I agree with you, Russell, that Taiwan is in the crosshairs of Chinese political warfare, and it is arguably the number one concern for China. So what I wanted to do is, what I'd like to do now is just to quote from one of the United Front Work Department writings, just to highlight to you not only their worldview, but Taiwan's kind of place in it. So let me just read this passage. The circumstances surrounding our efforts to win hearts and minds remain complex, grim, and urgent. Long-term residents long-term residence in capitalist environments has exposed Hong Kong, Macau, Taiwan, and overseas compatriots to Western values. Their values and lifestyles differ sharply from those that prevail on the mainland interior. Western hostile forces have always used Hong Kong, Macau, and Taiwan as pawns to contain us. These factors have all imposed higher demands on winning the people's hearts. I think that gives you a sense of the United Front and the party's worldview and Taiwan's place in it. And then the literature goes on to say one of the key jobs of the United Front is to win the hearts and minds of Taiwan's youth in order to influence the next generation's thinking about one China policy and so forth. This is very troubling. But I think what this shows, though, on the positive side, is that Taiwan's very existence as a free society, as a vibrant democracy, is not only an affront, but a fundamental challenge to the nature of the regime in Beijing. So I think one simple takeaway is Taiwan, as it is, as a vibrant, free democracy, is ultimately itself a powerful sort of weapon or a powerful tool. I would go back to Taiwan's own experiences, not only in recent years, but to go back to the history. I actually think that there are a lot of historical experiences that we can probably learn from in terms of Taiwan's experience with Chinese political warfare. And arguably, if you take this all the way back to the origins of the first United Front, the United Front is almost 100 years old, right? When the communists joined the nationalists in 1923, this is a long span of history of United Front tactics and strategies. I think we need to go back to that history. And again, Taiwan has a lot to teach us, to teach the rest of the world, and I think we need to learn and draw from those lessons. Thank you.
So recently I had the opportunity to be in Taipei, and I went to the big bookstore, the 24-hour bookstore there, mm-hmm. and I was struck by the fact that I could see everything on those shelves from Byron Face of Mao Zedong, Jiang Zemin, the governance of China, to modern Chinese politics, and it was this huge panoply of the history of China and political thought, and it was so vibrant. And the contrast between that section and what's happening right now within China, where even Deng Xiaoping himself is being marginalized in the discourse about reform and opening up, and Xi Jinping is being promoted. It's so striking, that contrast. It really speaks to the soft power that Taiwan has, I think, as a vibrant Asian democracy and one that is able to examine itself, examine China, and showcase democratic values. I think that we can learn from Taiwan, and Taiwan can also step up and also try more actively promote that. It's a thriving Asian democracy, and there's a real opportunity now to highlight those values at a time when people are grasping for these examples. Maybe more in that vein, and to get a little more specific, I know there's the new southbound policy and so on, but, you know, again, the contrast between some of the values inherent in these other approaches, providing positive models and positive incentives for countries both in the region and around the world to look at a time when there's increasing blowback around the Belt Road Initiative and some of the more coercive aspects of that are coming to the fore. I really feel like this is a great opportunity for Taiwan, and so I'm trying to end this on sort of a positive note, but there are these inherent strengths that it can showcase.
Right. Thank you. Bethany?
Sure. Probably going to sound like a broken record on this, but I think, you know, so Taiwan is like what ground zero for United Front activity outside of mainland China. They've been dealing with it for so long, and I want to know more about that experience. So obviously, you know, events like this are exactly what, should be happening, that, you know, we can learn about, you know, what has happened in Taiwan, what are the strategies there, how are you combating this, and how can we learn from that? And if, you know, Taiwan continues to be ground zero for new kinds of campaigns, like, you know, disinformation campaigns, we need to know about that. We need to be ready for that so that we're not taken by surprise like we were in 2016. And I'll just say that, you know, I lived in mainland China for 4 years, and I never went to Taiwan until about a year and a half ago. And I went, and it was like breathing the fresh air. You know, it was like a democratic Chinese language. You know, it was Chinese without all this Communist Party jargon, and it was so free. I could almost smell it. And I wish Taiwan would promote that more. You know, like there's this amazing democracy that's right under the shadow of this authoritarian country, and it has continued on for so long, which is incredible. And I just wish there were more opportunities for, you know, people to go there and see that.
Right. Well, now we have about 15 minutes for audience Q&A. All right. I see three hands. Why don't we collect those questions, and then we'll give a chance for the speakers to respond. So I see Rachel, Dee. Yes, right over here on the left. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Russell and Susan. It was a really excellent panel. Rachel Burton, the Project on Brain Institute, covering a lot of these issues at our own institutes. It's really wonderful to have this discussion here. I have one comment and then a question at the end of it. First, to Toshi, to your question about United Front Work in wartime. One incident that really comes to my mind in terms of history is really looking at the role of United Front Work in Tibet while the PLA was annexing Tibet, and the role that United Front Work did in terms of coming in behind the PLA and how that was set up, and you know, United Front Work activities in Tibet from the 50s to this day, I think, is an understudied case. And then I came to address the sort of the panel's answers to Taiwan's role in countering political warfare. I want to flip that question a little bit and ask the panel, you know, for the United States under the TRA and our obligations to the TRA, what can the U.S. do to extend legitimacy to the government of Taiwan in order to counter the CCP political warfare? Like, is there something we can do to extend legitimacy to the government of Taiwan underneath an Indo-Pacific banner? Because so much of what you say that, you know, Taiwan needs to showcase its soft power, needs to showcase its democracy, I see Taiwan doing that. I see its president doing that. I see its people doing that. I see its civil society doing that. Taiwan Foundation for Democracy, they're shouting it loud. They're shouting it proud. How can the United States government or Congress, civil society, and educational institutions provide and then continue to provide legitimacy to the government?
Let's go back to Richard. Let's go back to Dee over there.
So this is Dee from Focus and Association for Public Affairs. So I found that the United Front Work operations is quite similar to Chinese spying operations, and it is typically called the thousand grains of sand. People say that if the U.S. wants to extract the sands from the beach, they would use satellites, and Russians would send the troops to the shore at night to stamp the sands, and Chinese would send 1,000 tourists to stamp the sands. And I think this is quite similar to how Chinese do their United Front Work operations. So since Chinese is so deeply penetrate and comprehensively penetrate the United States or other countries, how can democracies systematically and institutionally counter the operations of the CCP? Thank you.
And then the final question over here.
Thank you so much for your time. Nicholas Romero, I'm representing myself right now. My question relates to, I have two questions. One is, it seems like Washington, D.C. is becoming increasingly aware of these sorts of activities, but are there other places in the country? I mean, Hollywood was mentioned to some degree, but are there other places in the United States that should perhaps be more aware of these sorts of activities, like financial centers, for instance, in New York City, or technological centers, for instance, in Silicon Valley? Do you get the sense that Silicon Valley has an understanding of Chinese influence operations to the same degree that people in Washington, D.C. do? And I ask that question in light of what we've seen in recent months, and it's been discussed, mentioned at places like the Atlantic Council and the Capitol National Security Forum, wherein you saw Google employees, for instance, refused to work with the United States Air Force on Project Maven, and Amazon employees revolting against their company's partnerships with the Department of Homeland Security. These are activities, while they might be indigenous to American employees of those companies could also be co-opted by United Front Work Group representatives in, for instance, Silicon Valley. My other question is, it pertains to what we might see in warfare, and perhaps we might already be seeing that with regards to the tariffs that are being levied back and forth and the trade war that's starting to erupt between the United States and China. And we see in Xinhua and CGTN, for instance, interviewing farmers and industries in red states as being victims of Chinese counter-tariffs to the United States. So it seems to me like the Chinese are almost in some way already engaged in political warfare activities relating to the tariffs and also promoting how those things are undermining, say, the Trump administration. And they're promoting that in Chinese media. I was wondering if you guys might comment on that. Thank you.
Great. So a great set of first round of questions. So we have the TRA and extending legitimacy to Taiwan as a countermeasure to political warfare. The level of penetration, how do you respond to that with such a deep level of penetration? Looking at, United Front in financial sectors and tech sectors and also terrorists as a sort of the sort of ongoing trade friction as a and targeting of terrorists as a means of political warfare.
So let me just bite off just a
sure.
couple
okay. sure. yeah, please.
Mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. The first on the Silicon Valley front. At one level, I think Silicon Valley knows exactly what the Chinese government is and is happy to engage on its own terms when it serves them. And for further proof, you can look at the recent story about Apple and the Taiwan flag being blocked on Chinese iOS, and that only came to light because people were sending text messages saying, what are you saying? You're not making sense. And the person would say, I sent you a Taiwan flag. And the other person says, no, you didn't. That's because Apple made this change behind scenes, didn't tell anybody about it. That's also tied into the fact that Apple has quite demonstrably, in the recent past, been willing to show up at events that the Chinese government has convened, like the Wuhan Internet Conference, or to generally be sympathetic to those things. So at that level, I think that the top leaders know what the Chinese government is and what it will take to do business there eventually. But also at another level, I think there's probably a tendency among Silicon Valley to look at the Chinese tech sector and say, you know what, they're just like us, right? I mean, they say all the right things. We want to sort of not do evil, and they want to not do evil, and they're just being pressured, and, we all have the same slogans and the same outlook and so on. I'm not sure there's really a more nuanced understanding of the ways in which, especially at the leadership level, there are tie-ins with the party and where leaders of tech companies are, if at one point they were able to be more independent, increasingly in the recent past, they're no longer able to fully be so independent. And they're increasingly either susceptible to pressure or willingly going along with the objectives of the Chinese government in order to advance their businesses. And the second point, just very briefly on the penetration issue, I do think we have to be careful in how we frame this. I think because of globalization, we are all deeply intertwined with one another, and it is highly unlikely that we, democracies and authoritarian regimes and all the rest of it, are going to become suddenly unentwined. So it's about how we condition the nature of that entanglement and that entwinement, and that's where perhaps legislation such as that introduced in Australia and other types of legislation introduced in democracies to shed sunlight on some of these more covert activities is absolutely necessary. But I would not want the idea that, democracies are being penetrated by the Chinese population to be the one that informs this type of work going forward. I think that would be sort of an unhealthy rubric for it to be put under.
Thank you. Shanti?
So I think that Shanti said she put it very well in terms of Silicon Valley. I want to double down on that a little bit. I don't think that companies are not fundamentally democratic. They operate by whatever gives them the bottom line. And to the extent that appearing to want to push back at the U.S. government is good for them, and they're able to do that. Apple or whoever can be like, we're not going to give you our encryption keys or whatever. They can do that here, and it is shocking to me and stunning that a place like Apple, when it comes to a different government, so not the U.S. government, but a different government, will just roll right over. Because that's where the money comes from. And I think that that is something that needs to kind of reframe how we view capitalism. That's something that, you know, in the past few years has kind of become popular to say, you know, or become more well understood that there is liberal capitalism and there's illiberal capitalism. And, you know, China, if you want to call it sharp power, they have learned how to use capitalism to project illiberal, power abroad. And I think certainly that's happening in Silicon Valley, that's happening in Hollywood. That's a very severe problem that I don't think we've even begun to know how to address from a standpoint of democratic values. In terms of, again, United Front networks, right, in D.C. there's a growing understanding of what the United Front Work Department is. The two other places where it's a really severe problem are New York City and the entire state of California. And so if you want to follow someone who's doing really good work on that, you should follow Nick Dorfman. He's the best on this. He's based in California, and he's coming out with some really great work on that. But there are it's a very, very severe problem in both of these locations, and I don't think that there's a sort of civil society or a public understanding that this is a problem. And I'll leave it there.
So I'll try to answer the first two questions about the Taiwan Relations Act. I mean, I think that it's time for the United States to be less apologetic about its relationship with Taiwan, and that we need to make efforts to engage Taiwan on its own terms, because it is a qualitative good to engage Taiwan, not because of the hyphenation of China-Taiwan, right? That I think we need to, because of the very things we talked about, because of Taiwan's vibrant democracy, it is in and of itself a qualitative good that we need to promote and to encourage and to protect. And so the things that we've done, including the Taiwan Travel Act that helps to upgrade our relationship with Taiwan, I think is all to the good. I think we need to insist that we to make clear that we have our own interpretation of the One China policy, that we're not going to get rolled over by China's version of the One China policy. And I think that those are all important ways, I think, of protecting, you know, providing that protective shell around Taiwan. I think this issue about the penetration, I'm going to focus more on the possibility from a military security perspective on Taiwan, which is that my reading of history is that these types of fifth column things where they come out in the open in times of crisis of war, they tend to fizzle. If you think about the historical record, the one in which a rising of people coming out and actually overturning a regime because of the sudden outburst of these fifth column folks, the only example I can really think of in modern history is the Russian Revolution. Let's go through the other ones where they failed. Easter Uprising, failure. China's own Nanchang Uprising, failure. Algeria Rising, failure. The Tet Offensive, really, frankly, when the Viet Cong came out, they got wiped out, failure. Partly because the people that are rising up are people who are, you know, scum, right? They're your mortal enemies, right? And think about the Tet Offensive. When they came out, and the local South Vietnamese realized what the Viet Cong was about, they could not succeed because the local population turned their backs on them. So I think as long as, again, Taiwan remains true to itself, I remain confident that the Taiwanese population won't be turned as a result of these, you know, fifth column forces inside of Taiwan. That when they come out in the open, my hope is that if my reading of history is correct, those folks who come out in the open will be in trouble.
We have time for one more round of questions. Okay, let's see. We have gentleman right there. Okay, Rich.
Hi, Matt Turpin. Last night, FireEye, the cybersecurity firm, released a report on a Chinese espionage group turning Cambodia ahead of its elections in July of this year. and connected it to sort of broader economic espionage work that they've been doing. Just wanted to see if that, you know, how do you see this sort of cyber activity connecting to United Front work and other interference that the Chinese have been doing? And what this means in terms of intervention and manipulation of election activities.
Interesting. Okay. I think Paul in the back over there.
Hi, Paul Wong-Bung. Quick question. Should there be increased communication cooperation between U.S. intelligence and Taiwanese intelligence, specifically FBI and Taiwan's National Security Bureau? Because as a matter of fact, so far that channel, the exchange has been on.
And just take. All right, we have a couple more hands here. Let's get these. Let's hopefully get these questions in here too, also as well. This gentleman, yeah.
Thank you. My name is Chris Cruz. I have a question. We talked a bit about how the U.S. policymakers that work in China is kind of influence at home and among other Western democracies our allies. My question is, what can we do to help counter or help other countries in developing democracies who may not be our allies and may be suspicious of our motives to help combat this kind of influence?
Interesting. Jennifer?
Jennifer Chang with Business Futures. My question is for Bethany. How does the CCP create that disinformation regarding ethnic minority groups in China, particularly the population, given racism and phobia in China? What role does the United Front of other Chinese countries play in this?
So I'm an NFRBA, and my comment or question is that I've heard a lot of, I would say, over-reliance on the rhetoric of liberal democracy, and you know, in the era of Brexit and all the major changes around the world, I think that it's a faulty narrative. And if you're going to emphasize democracy versus authoritarianism, then the countries that become more authoritarian will gravitate towards China's side. But, however, I see the counter-narrative that's rising behind liberal democracy is national sovereignty. And it's certainly a very cogent issue for, you know, president, but also Taiwan. And in my view, if you emphasize the rhetoric of national sovereignty, you know, against an expansion power like China, then I think that would be a more convincing argument than if you were to emphasize shared values, etc.
Okay. Well, great. Thank you. Okay, and this is close out all our questions. So we have one on cyberspace and how that how's that used for United Front activities, with a reference to the Cambodia, intel sharing, capacity building among non-democratic partners, CCP disinformation towards the Muslim community. And the narrative question about how we frame the narrative, how that impacts this between democracy versus authoritarian and national sovereignty. All right. Who wants to take the first crack?
Okay, I'll take a very short first crack.
Okay.
With respect to the Cambodia example, I don't have a great deal of additional information on that besides obviously the FireEye report itself, but I do think this is one of the things that prompted me to raise sort of the disinformation piece as a key concern, because I think it indicates a growing willingness to engage in these kinds of exploits that are deliberately intended to disrupt democracies, which is, again, something very much out of the Russian government playbook. Traditionally, China hasn't been seen in that way. You know, it's sort of the, you know, we're just going to do our thing, you guys do your thing, and we have this long-term approach and so on. And so this is really the first time that I think attention has been concentrated on something specifically election-related outside of Taiwan, I would say, which obviously there's been a lot of highlights for that. So I would love to pay more attention to this, and I hope folks are doing that. I'm sure they are in the U.S. and elsewhere. You know, with respect, I'll just touch on the sovereignty versus values question. Of course, I'm from the National Endowment for Democracy, so I would, you know, I do genuinely think that democratic values are democratic values, not necessarily democratic countries all the time, because none of us can ever hope to always live up to those values. But those values do carry an inherent appeal sovereignty issue, I think, can be very powerful. But to me, I always find it a little tricky because China also makes a sovereignty argument. It has for years. It said, you know, we don't interfere in your affairs. And that's actually carried a lot of weight with folks and in the developing world. And so I think it's always a little bit of a double-edged sword to invoke sovereignty for me, the values argument, even though democracies certainly are in a difficult time right now and perhaps not all are living up to those values, but the inherent appeal is still there in my mind.
On the issue of intelligence sharing between the FBI and Taiwan, yes, let's have more of that, if possible. On the issue of national sovereignty, so again, I would completely agree with Shanti. I think it's a double-edged sword, and I think it's insufficient. So for example, if we want to say like this is going to be the main way that we push back against what China is doing in other countries. Yes, like that would be, a way to, a blunt shield against, how can you do this? You always say that you don't, interfere in the domestic affairs of other countries. You're being hypocritical and wrong. Like that would be useful for that. But that would be super not useful for issues like the 300,000 Uyghurs who are currently being, put in concentration camps in Xinjiang. There are international issues related to that, but mostly that's happening in Xinjiang. And so if we're saying that's the basis on which we're going to relate to China, what about the Uyghurs? What about all these sort of internal, very severe human rights problems? And this was the main reason that the entire word genocide was created after World War II, because part of what was happening was, and there was already a concept that war crimes are bad, but what if you're killing vast segments of your population and it's not a wartime and it's only inside your own borders? There was no legal framework at that time that made that illegal or made that wrong or made that bad. And so national sovereignty is insufficient for a better world. And I think that's kind of what we care about here. That's sort of the larger issue that we're talking about is what is a better world, right? And what was there? Oh, the disinformation about inside of China. And maybe, Shanti, you'd be better on this. Since it's disinformation, but I would say that generally, I don't really know if United Front networks are so involved in that, but generally the way that the party approaches these issues is by saying, look at all the happy dancing minorities. They really love the party. So the Tibetans are happy, the Uyghurs are happy, everyone's happy. We don't really have a problem with Islamophobia. So that's not disinformation. That's per se, that's propaganda, which I guess is maybe a kind of disinformation. But that's sort of like the line that you get on that. And so about developing countries or sort of fragile or vulnerable democracies. So what we've been talking about a lot of is, the CCP's arsenal against established mature democracies. It's different when you have a country like Cambodia or, various countries on the African continent or in Central Asia that are not democracies whatsoever or are pseudo-democracies or on some kind of spectrum. They don't need to be so subtle. They can just go, to the leader and be like, hey, we're going to have this infrastructure deal. You're just not going to criticize us, and that's going to be fine, right? And, the local strongman or dictator was like, yeah. Fine, that's great. So they don't need some of these more subtle tools because they're not dealing with like a well-established civil society that needs to be very carefully brought over to China's side because they can use the more traditional, harder elements of power.
So just very quickly, I assumed that there was intel sharing, but clearly I assumed wrong. So there are clearly gaps of knowledge that we need to fill. We need to know better about that relationship and to upgrade it comprehensively. Developing countries, yeah. I thought what was fascinating was the incident with the New York Times reporting of the debt diplomacy in Sri Lanka and the huge pushback that came out of China because we clearly hit a sore spot by exposing one of the things that they were doing. I think that's again, that highlights the fact that exposure, bringing sunlight to the problem, actually can put China on its back heels. And finally, the United Front writings take heart in the fact that the Western model is apparently not functioning well or has demonstrated dysfunction. I think we've been far more resilient, and I think we need to prove the party wrong. We proved the party wrong after the financial crisis. They were convinced after 2008 that we were in terminal decline, right? And they've had to reevaluate the resilience of the United States and the capitalist system. They could not believe when we had a government shutdown that we could function, right? Which reflects in some ways a fundamental misunderstanding of how democracies function, or the American democracy functions, right? Our day-to-day lives do not rely on the federal government, right? It's all about local politics, local municipalities that actually run our lives. It's a fundamental misunderstanding on the part of the Chinese. So I think one of the things we need to do is to prove the Chinese wrong in their assessment about the inherent vulnerabilities and weaknesses of democracies.
Well, with that, that brings our session today to a close. I think you will all agree that with such a thought-provoking discussion, it raises more questions than really provides the answers. And so, but that gives think tanks like GTI and others to engage more on these questions. And last but not least, I want to again extend our thanks to the Seeker Center for co-sponsoring today's event. This wouldn't have been possible without the co-sponsorship. Thank you very much, Richard Haddock. All right.